Hey, Notorious Bakersfield fans. Notorious Bakersfield the book is available for purchase. If you enjoyed this podcast, you'll love the book. Notorious Bakersfield the book dives deeper into the most infamous crimes, incidents, and personalities that have shaped Bakersfield. This literary adaptation uncovers 30 astonishing true stories from Bakersfield and Kern counties last century. Notorious stories from a notorious community. To purchase your copy, go to Amazon.com or your Amazon app and search for Notorious Bakersfield, the book. This is the Notorious Bakersfield podcast. I'm Robert Peterson, the host and creator of this podcast that takes a look back at some of Bakersfield's most notorious crimes, events, and characters. After taking a couple of weeks off for the holidays, Notorious Bakersfield is back. I hope everyone had a good holiday and ready to start the new year. Without any more delay, let's get right into this week's Notorious Bakersfield story, the first episode for the year 2024. On a quiet Saturday morning in early November 1987, about 8:30 in the morning, Genevieve Pierce, a 72-year-old woman, and her 80-year-old brother took their trash cans out to the alley. They live there on the corner of 2nd Street and Holtby Road in the Oleander neighborhood. While they are doing this mundane chore, something caught Genevieve's attention. About a half a block up the alley was what appeared to be a bundle of discarded clothing, lying there in the middle of the alley. Genevieve walked towards it. She was going to pick it up and throw it away. As she approached this heap, her eyes began to focus. With each step she took, Genevieve slowly realized this wasn't discarded clothing. It was a person, a body. In that instant, Genevieve's curiosity transformed to shock and fear. She shrieked. It echoed up and down the alleyway and caught her brother's attention. She turned and ran in the direction of her home, back towards her brother. The elderly siblings rushed for the safety of their home and called 911. This is Secret Witness. Russell Clark was being raised by his mother, Marilyn Clark, a single parent. They lived in the 300 block of Holtby Road in the Oleander neighborhood in central Bakersfield. Marilyn worked as a clerk with the Kern High School District. Marilyn was just 17 years old when she had Russell in 1970. The mother and son were extremely close. As Russell matured into a teenager, they became even closer. Marilyn described their relationship as more of a best friend relationship than mother-son. She said Russell felt comfortable confiding in her with whatever was going on in his life. They were so close, in fact, that when Russell got braces on his teeth, Marilyn decided to get braces on hers too. She felt she needed and always wanted them. But the main reason for Marilyn making the decision to get braces was to show solidarity for her only child. When you think of the typical student at Bakersfield's Vista High School, you don't think well-behaved or gifted. Vista High School had a reputation for taking in other schools' misfits, kids who were dangerously close to being expelled from other schools. Vista was their last resort, their last chance. But that doesn't seem to be the case for Russell Clark. Russell entered high school at Bakersfield High. He was a bright kid, very smart, in fact. He found BHS's pace too slow, and he got bored and began skipping classes. His mother, Marilyn, felt Vista's independent study program would benefit her son. So at her urging, Russell transferred from BHS to Vista High School for his junior year. The transfer seems to have been a good one. As a student, Russell thrived. Teachers and counselors at Vista said he was intelligent, inquisitive, and articulate. He got straight A's. He was listed among the 1986-87 school year of the who's who in American high schools for his academic achievements. Socially, Russell was well-adjusted. He had ample friends and several really close friends. He had a few hobbies. One was reading. Russell was a voracious reader. He loved books. He also enjoyed riding his bike and playing Dungeons and Dragons with friends. But the hobby he was most passionate about was music. He loved music. He bought himself a guitar and taught himself how to play it. Then he went on to teach his friends how to play guitar too. There was even talk about forming a band. On Friday evening, November 6th, 1987, Russell was in his room listening to Stairway to Heaven by Led Zeppelin. He came out of his room and he told his mom he was going to his friend Eric's house, just around the corner from their Holtby Road house. The two friends were going to practice guitar, something he and Eric spent hours doing. As he walked out the door, he told his mom his parting words, "Peace, Mom." Marilyn went to bed that night before her son got home. Some people may wonder, what about his curfew? Here's the thing. Russell didn't need a curfew. It was just understood that if he was going to be out later than normal, he should call home, let his mom know what was happening. That's what a good kid he was. Marilyn had no behavioral or discipline issues with her son at all. When Marilyn woke up the next morning and Russell wasn't in his bed, she began to worry. She called Eric's house, his friend. Eric told her Russell wasn't there. The last time Eric saw Russell was when he was walking home. It was around Bank and B Streets, across from the Roosevelt Elementary School's playground, about a block from his house on Holtby Road. That was about 10 o'clock the night before. Only a couple of hours after discovering Russell hadn't come home, and a few frantic phone calls to his friends, there was a knock on Marilyn's door. It was a pair of detectives asking Marilyn to describe the clothing Russell was wearing the night before. When her description matched the clothing on the body Genevieve Pierce found in her alley, the detectives showed Marilyn a picture. Marilyn positively identified it as her only child, her son, 17-year-old Russell Allen Clark. The teenager had been killed by a single bullet fired at close range to the left side of his head. In an interview with the Bakersfield Californian, Marilyn said, quote, "It was his poor, sweet face, and he was dead. He had such a shocked look on his face," unquote. Russell Clark was born March 13, 1970, a Friday the 13th. His funeral was held at Bakersfield St. Francis Church. Then he was interred in a crypt at Greenlawn Cemetery on November 13, 1987, also a Friday the 13th. When making her son's funeral arrangements at Greenlawn, Marilyn purchased an adjoining crypt for herself. Russell was survived by his mother Marilyn, father Alan, close family friend Herbert Romine, and a grandmother. Bakersfield police detectives set out investigating everyone who had a connection to the teenager. Anyone who had contact with him immediately prior to his murder in that dark alley on November 6th. What perplexed investigators was trying to interpret Russell's last movements before his death. When his friend last witnessed Russell, he was walking eastbound on Bank Street near B Street. In order to go home, Russell would have had to turn left on Holtby Road, heading north. But for unknown reasons, he went to that alley, which was in the opposite direction of his home. Why was he in that alley? Did he go there on his own, or was he chased there? That was the mystery to not only police, but to everyone who knew Russell. Also, who'd want to harm Russell? Someone with no known enemies. Within a month of Russell's murder, Kern County's Secret Witness Program published an account of Russell's case in the Bakersfield Californian. A reward of $5,000 was offered to anyone who had information regarding his death. Marilyn suffered tremendous grief over the loss of her only child. As weeks turned into months without an arrest, her grief was compounded with frustration. Marilyn's frustration wasn't with the police investigating the case. She felt detectives were working as hard as they possibly could to solve her son's murder. Her frustration was that of feeling like somebody knew more and they weren't stepping forward. She was also frustrated by the fact that the caseload for the detectives working Russell's murder was continually growing. She feared that as time passed without Russell's homicide being solved, his case would become less of a priority for police. The investigation into Russell Clark's slaying seemed to be stalled. Police interviewed and administered a polygraph test to some people of interest, but no suspects emerged. On August 1, 1988, almost 8 months after Russell's death, an article by Michael Trihe was published in the Bakersfield Californian. In that article, Marilyn described the grief she was experiencing since Russell's killing. She detailed how her life was turned upside down since his death. She also relayed her frustrations with the lack of progress detectives were making. Marilyn said, quote, "I've got to know. There is someone out there who knows something. I just like to ask that person, whoever he is, to please come forward to relieve my mind so I can know the truth about what happened to my son, so I can get along with my life and try to make peace with it." Unquote. Marilyn was so desperate to find answers to her son's homicide that she turned to a psychic for help. But the only answer the psychic could give was the reassurance that Russell was in heaven. Accompanying that article in the Bakersfield Californian was a photograph of the still grieving mother cradling her late son's guitar. Marilyn Clark went public with her grief and frustration with the hope that her story about her son's case would provoke someone to come forward. She hoped anyone who had information about the person who killed Russell to contact the Secret Witness Program or detectives. And it worked. Someone did eventually call the Secret Witness hotline. This anonymous person only identified himself as Richard. Homicide detectives met with Richard in a park. This Richard person didn't know all the details regarding the case, but he knew enough to point detectives in the right direction. About a month after interviewing Richard, the secret witness, police were able to identify and apprehend a suspect. He was 40-year-old Frankie Enriquez. When detectives interviewed Enriquez, he confessed to killing the teenager, but the suspect claimed the shooting was accidental. Frankie Enriquez's girlfriend lived in the 2100 block of Bank Street, about a half a block away from where Russell Clark was last seen. Enriquez claimed his girlfriend had an ongoing problem with a peeping Tom. On the night of Russell's murder, Enriquez was visiting his girlfriend's house there on Bank Street. They got into an argument about Enriquez going to a party without her. The girlfriend went to bed. Enriquez left for the party. He claimed as he stepped out of the house, he saw a youth running away. Enriquez chased this person into the alley. Enriquez caught the teenager in the alley. He was escorting him back to his girlfriend's house when, out of frustration and anger, Enriquez struck Russell, the ledge prowler, with the handle of a revolver. The gun accidentally discharged, shooting Russell Clark in the head. Immediately after the shooting, Enriquez went back to his girlfriend's house. He shook her awake to confess that he just shot someone. Even though he claimed it was an accident, Enriquez never called 911 to report the shooting or summon medical aid. No, he left Russell in the middle of that dark alley, only to be discovered the next morning by Genevieve Pierce. Enriquez said he discarded the murder weapon in the Kern River that same night shortly after the shooting. Frankie Enriquez went on trial for the slaying of Russell Allen Clark in January 1989, 14 months after the crime. Marilyn Clark sat in on every minute of the legal proceedings. She suffered through the pathologist's testimony, describing in gruesome detail the autopsy he conducted on her late son. She bit her tongue when Frankie Enriquez took the witness stand in his defense. She listened intently as Enriquez disparaged her son's character by claiming Russell Clark was trespassing, how he was the suspected peeping Tom. Enriquez's legal defense was the same as it was shortly after he was arrested. The shooting was an accident. He maintained the gun had a hair trigger. He knew it had a hair trigger because he fired the weapon on previous occasions. And from those experiences, he was well aware that it had a hair trigger. Since the defendant discarded the weapon after the shooting, it was never recovered. It couldn't be entered into evidence. But the same model of the .22 caliber revolver was entered into evidence. This demonstration weapon was rendered safe by removing its cylinder. Jurors were able to cock and dry fire the gun, testing the gun's alleged hair trigger. Each time the gun's hammer fell, the click reverberated throughout the courtroom. Some jurors even cocked the firearm and knocked it against their knees. They were testing the defendant's claim that the gun accidentally discharged when he hit the victim with its handle. These juror simulations never caused the weapon's hammer to fall. The district attorney was skeptical about the hair trigger argument. They asserted that if Enriquez was aware of the weapon's hair trigger, he should have handled the pistol with more care. After the jury was given their instructions, it took them less than an hour to find Frankie Enriquez guilty of second-degree murder. At his sentencing hearing, Marilyn Clark didn't disguise her anger. She told the judge the man who was found guilty for the murder of her only child was a monster, a lowlife. She said Frankie Enriquez deserved to be sentenced to life in prison. But a life sentence was impossible. Enriquez was found guilty of second-degree murder. There was no evidence the killing was premeditated. Marilyn Clark acknowledged that. She understood the judge's hands were tied, but the mourning parent conveyed her disappointment to the court nonetheless. She said the defendant's testimony put the victim, her son Russell, on trial. Enriquez was the only witness to the crime because he killed the other witness, the victim, her son. Marilyn ended her testimony by saying all her son was guilty of was trying to come home that night. Frankie Enriquez was sentenced to 15 years to life in prison, plus 2 for using a gun in the crime. Frankie Enriquez was given that 17-year sentence in 1989. I assume he's been released by now. Something to keep in mind about this story. All of the relevant locations associated to this crime, where Russell Clark and his mother lived, where Russell was last seen alive, the house where Frankie Enriquez was leaving when he saw Russell, and the alley where Enriquez killed Russell. Those locations are all within a block to a block and a half from each other. They're all right around Bank Street and Holtby Road. There are fences to a couple of residences that back up to that alley between 2nd and Bank Street off of Holtby Road that have murals painted on them. Several different scenes. A couple of them are memorials. One mural is a memorial to Kobe Bryant. Wouldn't it be nice if there was a mural memorializing Russell Clark, someone whose life was taken in that alley? Resources used to research this story: the Bakersfield Californian and findagrave.com. This is Robert Peterson. Thank you for listening to this episode. I'll be back next week, next Tuesday, with another notorious Bakersfield story. Until then, stay safe, stay out of trouble, don't become a future episode of the Notorious Bakersfield podcast.
Just helping you out with your facts there.